Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. Thank you, our most important guest, our listener, for joining us today. This is Jane Kawaski, Dr. J, with my co-host, Jim Nico. I'm an experimental psychologist who likes to ponder how social networking and media have connected us to global information. But that's not all. Our digital possessions connect us to much more. They connect us to global contamination and injustice. Yes, that is the dark side of the silicon chip. Environmentalist and activist Ted Smith joins us again to continue our exploration of responsible technology. What is it in our devices, from iPhone and Android, computers, laptops, tablets, mobile devices that's causing this kind of contamination and health risks for the people who build them, and where do they come from? Who makes them? Under what conditions? And what happens when they become obsolete? So we'll be talking about some of those issues with Ted Smith, the coordinator of the International Coalition for Responsible Technology. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Ted.
Thanks very much. I'm really glad to be able to be here.
So we have been talking in our previous interview about how this whole situation with the health risks of the electronics industry is really somewhat parallel to what we went through with the tobacco industry. And of course, there's many warnings and safeguards and so forth, but and fewer people are smoking. But what did we learn from that process that can perhaps be useful in guarding against the health risks involved in the electronics industry?
Well, I do think that there are some parallels, both in terms of problem identification and then also in solution development. The similarities in terms of the problem identification is that for years, people in the tobacco industry denied that there was any problem and that they, took the position that smoking and health had no connection. And even after the evidence was in for decades, literally, they kept trying to argue that. And it was really, it was pretty clear. It was just in order to try to protect their bottom line. But eventually, and again, it took way too long, the combination of lawsuits and legislation and the emerging and just ever clearer science on the causation of smoking and lung cancer eventually got to the point where there was a significant change in people's behavior, and we saw all the laws that you can no longer smoke in restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. The similarity in electronics, I think, is that we have too often seen the same kind of head-in-the-sand kind of denial, and the companies are even reluctant or insistent at times of not even disclosing what are the hazardous chemicals that their workers are working with. One of the things we did early on here, which I'm very proud of, is that in 1983, we passed a right-to-know ordinance all throughout Silicon Valley, which said that any company that was using hazardous materials in their workplaces had to disclose that publicly. So for 30 years, we've actually had access to that kind of information. But that's still very rare in many other parts of the world, where workers are exposed to chemicals, and the brands, which are ultimately responsible for all this, still don't even disclose the chemicals used by the supply chain workers. And in many cases, they don't even know what they are. They've just kind of washed their hands of it. So we're still at the stage of trying to get past the denial and into an acknowledgement that, yes, there are problems, and there are some solutions. We think that if the companies will disclose the chemicals being used, they can at least then start doing assessments to figure out how to replace the worst ones with safer chemicals, and that'll be good for everybody. It'll be good for the workers, it'll be good for the environment, and it'll be good for the products themselves, which at end of life have to be recycled, and the more toxic materials that are in the end-of-life products, the more hazardous it is for people involved in the recycling of those products. So when you look at it from a life cycle perspective, it's almost a no-brainer to say we need to have cleaner production methods, we need to have safer materials, and we need to be serious about doing this rather than continuing to deny that there's a problem or trying to pretend that it's going to go away on its own.
Another thing I got out of your book, Challenging the Chip, Labor Rights and Environmental Justice in the Global Economics Industry, was that we so often think everything is made in China, and so many Chinese or I don't know if it's so much Chinese or the Asian, it almost amounts to a yellow peril type of attitude, but so much ownership of companies in the United States. But when I read those chapters about how so much e-waste, electronic waste, these obsolete devices are shipped over to China and other countries, and I don't know if you can say dumped, but they're there, and they're little cottage industries recycling these things, and complete with all the toxic materials in them. So it kind of flips the situation. You see where, they are being victimized in many ways by this great industrial boom that is occurring in China and other Asian countries.
Yeah, it's another part of the just unbelievable injustice of the whole global system, because the products are now largely made in the developing world. You're largely consumed in the developed world. But at end of life, when people discard their products, and as you know, it's oftentimes only after a few months or maybe a year or two, the enormous volume of e-waste is already the fastest growing section of waste in the world, and it's a lot cheaper to put it into a container and put it on a ship and send it over to China or India or Pakistan or any number of places, because to recycle it properly in the U.S. is fairly expensive because of the fact that they have these nasty materials in them. They have to treat old computers and old electronic products as hazardous waste, which means that they're subject to the hazardous waste laws, which means it's expensive to do. But if you ship it to Asia, then you get these backyard facilities that don't have any health and safety protections, and people are burning the plastics to get the metals. They're using acids to try to, recover the precious metals. Mm-hmm. And there's emerging evidence of studies showing, massive numbers of children and young women getting terrible diseases from the exposure to the hazards at this end-of-life processing part of things. So it's another thing that is just completely unacceptable. And we were involved in publishing a report in 2002 called Exporting Harm, and it documented this in great detail with pictures and diagrams and text. And since then, I think that there has been a greater awareness that this is a grave injustice, but we still have a long way to go to try to thread that needle again. We need economic development. Poor people do need jobs, but they don't need jobs that are going to be killing them and their children. So we have to find the right balance where people can survive economically, but at the same time do it in a way that is going to be more sustainable.
What do you see as the most fascinating part of your work today? I mean, like right now, if you don't mind.
Well, we have identified Apple and Samsung as the two most important technology companies in the world right now. They are, as you know, the leaders in mobile technology. The mobile platform is increasingly the platform of choice for most consumers. I'm sure you know mm-hmm. that the sales of computers are actually flattening out, whereas the sales of mobile devices, the phones and tablets, et cetera, are just skyrocketing. And in that arena, Apple and Samsung are clearly the technology leaders. They are also two of the wealthiest companies in the world, and they have the resources, the know-how, and they also have their brand reputation, which means that if they are persuaded that it's in their own corporate self-interest to protect workers in the community, they have the resources to be able to do that. They have the wherewithal to be able to do that. And so I'm actually somewhat encouraged by what I've seen just in the last few months of some of the responses. And I've mentioned that the CEO of Samsung has offered this apology because of the terrible situation of the young women in Korea getting these blood cancers after working in these chip plants. And I'm also encouraged that Apple, in response to some of the terrible press that they've been getting coming out of Asia through Foxconn and other disasters, has hired Lisa Jackson to come in and to try to clean up their whole environmental program. Now, we'll see how much she can do. We'll see if she really has the authority needed. We're hoping that there will be some progress along those lines in the not-too-distant future. Because, again, I really do believe this industry is enormously innovative. That's their stock and trade. And when they put their mind to something, they can do incredible things. Just a quick example. In the late 1980s, when it was discovered that the chlorofluorocarbons, or the CFCs, were destroying the ozone layer,
mm-hmm.
global community got together and passed what is known as the Montreal Protocol, calling on countries all around the world to phase out the use of these CFCs. It turned out that the electronics industry was one of the largest users of CFCs and dischargers in the United States and in the world. And so when we learned that, we focused on them and said, we want you to switch out and establish safer substitutes. And again, at the time, the first response was, well, you know, we're not sure it's that big a problem, and even if it is, there's other people that are also responsible, and we're not sure what to do, blah, blah, blah. But within a relatively short period of time, we had a major demonstration at the gates of IBM in 1989, and within a year after that, they had developed an alternative and completely phased out CFCs, and they replaced it with another solvent, which was essentially soap and water. So it was a tremendous improvement. And again, after the denial, it turned out to be a relatively straightforward, uncomplicated fix, and had a tremendous benefit for the environment. And so we know that they have that innovative skill. That's what their whole stock is in terms of developing the new products. And if they put that to use to try to develop more sustainable products from a life cycle perspective, I think that they can do a lot. It's just that we have to continue to build the awareness and the pressure to get them to do that. Because on the other hand, you know, they're all facing these quarterly profit demands of Wall Street.
And that is something I'd like to really focus on. And so let's do that in our next segment. And we'll talk about the Wall Street shareholder, corporation, and investor mix, and do that in our next segment.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Kelly Keller, an intellectual property attorney specializing in internet law and social media issues. Join me on The Kelly Keller Show right here on the Social Network Station. Together with my guests, we will tackle tough legal problems presented by the ever-increasing use of social media in everyday business. Through dynamic conversations, we will discuss your rights and responsibilities in the new media world so the hard work you have put into developing your brand, business, and products does not go to waste. How does the law's response to the social media explosion affect you? Join me on The Kelly Keller Show to learn more.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show, where we are having an interesting, fascinating discussion with Ted Smith, an environmental activist who is working especially with the whole issue of cleaning up the global contamination and injustice that accompanies all of our wonderful mobile devices and computers and so forth. So, Ted, we were about to get into the issue of the bottom line, the profits of the corporations and how that all intersects with Wall Street and investors and so forth. So carry on with that idea, please.
I learned many years ago that one of the most difficult challenges was that major companies, the public companies, are under just enormous pressure to look good in the short term because of the need to show quarterly returns. And if you don't show good quarterly returns, Wall Street punishes you. We've seen that time and time again. So that really is kind of a straitjacket in trying to run a major global corporation.
Now, when you say Wall Street punishes you, how does that happen?
Wall Street analysts, on a quarterly basis, will estimate what a company's profits are supposed to be. And if you don't meet their expectations, they give you a bad grade, and then people sell your stock, and it goes down. So you lose money. I mean, it's a very kind of 1 + 1 = 2, or actually it's 1 - 1 = 0 kind of an equation. And anybody involved in the business of whether it's high tech or any other industry knows this from day one going into it. So when you say to a company, we want you to fix a problem, their first response is, what's it going to cost? And then they're going to say, what's the return on investment?
Mm-hmm.
And if you say, we want you to make a big fix, we want you to change your wastewater treatment facility so that you're not dumping as many toxic chemicals into the bay or into the river, et cetera, their approach would be to say, okay, it's going to cost X millions of dollars, and we may get a return on investment, but if it's going to be more than 18 months, which is kind of the outside frame that I've heard people talk about, they'll say that doesn't pencil out. We can't do that, even if it means we're going to continue to cause long-term harm, because that's what economists call an externalized cost. If the harm is not something that the company itself has to pay for, but other people end up paying for, then they don't have to factor that into their bottom line. So that's the dilemma that we're in, and why it's so important that we build these pressures to counteract the pressures of the short-term pressures of the financial markets. And I'm seeing that more and more of the CEOs in these companies are aware of this. Just two quick examples. Michael Dell, the founder of Dell Computer, decided recently that he wanted to take his company back private in order to get away from those kinds of short-term pressures, and they've done that now in the last year. I'm sure there's other complicated reasons why they did that, but that was certainly one of them. But the other insight that I got that I thought was really fascinating was that I've been a stakeholder now on outside stakeholder advisory groups to a number of the tech companies, and one of them is Sprint, the phone company,
mm-hmm.
which is really, I think, trying to do a better job than some of their rivals in addressing some of these concerns. And the CEO came to talk to our small group that was there, and he started out by saying, you know, I don't agree with everything that the Occupy Wall Street people are saying, but they do have one thing right. They have it right when they say that the short-term pressures of Wall Street are inhibiting and making our job that much more difficult. So I think they got that right. And for a CEO of a major company to say that publicly to a group of people like us, I thought was pretty impressive. And I think that the more and more that there is an awareness, both insiders and as well as outsiders, that this is a real challenge and we have to find better ways of getting around those short-term pressures. Because if we don't, there's no way we can build long-term sustainable solutions. Sustainability doesn't have a quarterly deadline. Sustainability is a lifetime kind of a commitment, and we have to find ways of making that work within the system, or else it just simply is going to continue to disintegrate.
Ted, are there any other innovative, conscience-bearing people in Wall Street that are on our side with this kind of stuff besides the Occupy movement that you're aware of?
Yeah, very much so. There's a whole group of people that are called socially responsible investors, and there's many different groups that are involved in this. Some of them are, in fact, investors that will solicit your funds for them to invest, and they will give you a return on the investment, and they have screening criteria for their portfolio. They will not invest in companies that are destroying the earth, or they will not invest in companies that are, there was a long period of time when the socially responsible investors were saying don't invest in South Africa when they had apartheid. So that's a fairly well-developed movement in the U.S., and there's billions of dollars under management by these SRI firms, and they are increasingly working with activists to help us put pressure on the companies. And we file shareholder resolutions. We've done quite a bit of that with a number of the companies, saying we want you to disclose the chemicals in your supply chain. We want you to disclose the occupational safety and health criteria that you're using. We want you to disclose what you're finding in your audits, those kinds of things. And when we can go into a company along with investors that say we represent billions of dollars of investment in your firm, we get paid attention to a lot more than if it's just us outside, you know, chanting slogans and carrying picket signs.
So how does that work in order to present something like that from shareholders? How do you identify the shareholders in the companies that are interested in doing that?
There is a fairly robust coalition between nonprofit activists and these socially responsible investment networks. One of them, by the way, is called ICCR, the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility, and that's a coalition of hundreds or maybe even thousands of religious shareholders. So it's like the pension funds of the Presbyterian Church nationally. I mean, those are very big operations. Or it could be companies such as Kaiser Permanente, which is a very large health organization, but which has also a pretty robust social justice aspect to it. But anyway, we work together and we'll identify particular campaigns that we think are important and particular companies where we might be able to make some headway in terms of either picking on somebody who is a real laggard, or in sometimes focusing on somebody that we think could make a breakthrough and actually set a higher bar and work with them to try to do that. So
the ones that are the farthest along and the ones that are the least advanced.
Yes.
Yeah.
A leaders and laggard strategy is something that we do quite frequently, and other groups do too, where you want to reward the leaders and say, we applaud the fact that you're stepping out and trying to show the way, whereas the people who are continuing to cut corners and try to, you know, make a little bit of extra money by not doing the right thing, we think that they need to be, punched in the marketplace, if nothing else.
Yeah. Ted, where can someone get a hold of any organization that can help? Websites, any other contact information you can give us, please?
I'll give you a few websites. The International Campaign for Responsible Technology is www.icrt.co, not com, just co. If you do Electronics Take Back Coalition, if you just Google that, you'll get their web address, and both of those websites are full of lots of information. There's another group based in Europe called Good Electronics, and if you Google on Good Electronics, you'll find that. There's a group based in Asia called the Asian Network for Occupational and Environmental Victims, ANROV, and again, they are in touch with organizing efforts in about 15 different countries throughout Asia. And so the information is increasingly available. There are many, many groups. This letter, as I said, that we just sent to Apple is now up on the website of Green America, and it has the names of, as I say, 80 organizations from around the world that we're asking Lisa Jackson to really take the lead in cleaning up the chemicals in the supply chain.
In your experience with similar things, what would you say is a percentage of response rate to open letters such as that? I don't know if that's exactly an open letter, but
It's a little hard to say. I think the letter by itself is probably not the key. It's what's the rest of the context. This effort here was also launched with a new short video, which documented some of the young workers, again, developing leukemia from exposure to chemicals on the job. There's a movie that has just been released in Korea based on the story of one of the young women who died from leukemia. It's gotten tremendous support all throughout Korea. It's a commercial movie. It's not a documentary.
Mm. And Challenging the Chip has been translated into Korean and Chinese?
That's right. It now is available in both Chinese and Korean. So that's a really big, big step, and we're really, really happy about that. And there's more and more books coming out. There's one I just got the other night called Invisible Hands, Voices from the Global Economy, brand new. There's another book that I'm going to have a chapter in that will be out later this year. From NYU Press, with, again, stories from around the world. So I think that this information is certainly growing. It's still not on the tip of everybody's tongue, but it is a lot easier to find things now. And as we continue to do a better job getting these stories out, I think that we're going to continue to be able to build this movement for safer products and more sustainable businesses.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, and you've really enriched our program, I think. So we have been speaking with Ted Smith of ICRT.co and learning a lot about the sustainability aspects of the electronics and digital revolutions that we're living in. So thank you for being with us on this edition of the Social Network Show, recorded at the lovely studios of KUNV, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. We'd love to hear from you, so please get in touch with us through questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. Every player on our site has more episodes listed at the top, so you can easily use that pull-down menu to browse for past shows you might have missed. And you'll also be able to replay our live show from 5 p.m. Sundays on News Talk 720 KDWN at the foot of our homepage. You can follow us on Twitter @SocialNetShow, as well as hear the show on our website, Stitcher.com, or iTunes, where you can add us to your playlist or favorites. Please have fun and be safe online and off until we welcome you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on the Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.